Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Mike Thompson represents the North Coast of California, including Mendocino County, the home of Radio Curious, in the United States House of Representatives. In this interview, recorded in Congressman Mike Thompson's Washington, D.C. office on October 11, 2007, we discuss the war, its funding, Medicare, marijuana, and the Children's Health Insurance Program. The House of Representatives was not able to overturn the President's veto of the Children's Health Insurance Program in a vote that occurred after this interview. We begin when I asked the Congressman about the war. Mike Thompson, welcome to Radio Curious.
Good to be here. Welcome to Washington, D.C.
Thank you. Let's talk about the war. The sign outside the door to your office here next to the Capitol has a figure, starts with a 9 and is followed with 12 digits of zeros.
$9 trillion. It's our national debt.
And when President Clinton left the White House, the budget was balanced.
Well, it was. There was still a national debt. There was, I think it was $3 trillion.
How do we justify that?
What's I don't think we do. You know, as you know, that's why when I came to Congress, I joined the Blue Dog Coalition, because the Blue Dogs are a group of moderate to conservative Democrats. But the their issue, the number one issue, and their anchor issue, has always been retiring the national debt and fiscal responsibility. And I believe that we need to, you know, pay for the bills that we pass. And I believe that it's bad policy to pass a debt like this on to future generations. And I think it's even worse to borrow the money in some of the places we're borrowing it. You know, we're borrowing money from China, and from Japan, from the OPEC nations. And I think that puts us at a real disadvantage. And I think that's something we should stop doing. The Iraq war has been funded almost entirely through borrowing. And as you know, all of the bills that have passed Congress to fund the Iraq war have all been supplemental bills. That means they come outside of the budget process. They're always a big number. The latest request from the Bush administration was $200 billion to provide further funding for the Iraq war. And this just has us on a very dangerous course.
Well, the request to provide funding is a money bill that has to be initiated in the House of Representatives. What would happen if the Speaker would refuse to accept any initiated bills or move them forward on the $200 billion request, for example?
She would no longer be Speaker. There'd be a revolt in the House, and there would be a bill passed, notwithstanding her objections.
Why would she no longer be Speaker?
Because there'd be a revolt in the House. There's not the votes to do that. There are in fact the votes to pass these funding bills. There's not an appetite in the House or any place else to leave our troops in Iraq without funding.
So would it be possible to fund a bill that is earmarked for specific expenditures, bringing the troops home, ending the war?
No, you already know the answer to that question.
We did that.
The House passed two bills, one to end the war, took up two bills, one to end the war, and I think we got 171 votes for that, far short of what we needed. Then we passed another bill, which was a supplemental bill with the funding that the President had requested, but including a timeline for redeploying our troops. And the House passed it, the Senate passed it, and the President vetoed it. And as you know, we don't have enough votes for an override. We're going to be very fortunate if we can override the Children's Health Bill, let alone the Iraq Bill.
Well, my question, asked in a different way that you may have just answered, the spirit of the 435 members of the House, 218 it takes to pass something out of the House, is to continue fighting the war?
Well, as I said, we passed one bill out of both houses that the president vetoed that provided the funding that the president asked for the Iraq war. And included in that bill was a timetable to redeploy our troops. It was basically the bill that that I authored with Senator Obama, and that bill was vetoed. There aren't enough votes to override the veto. There aren't enough votes in the Senate to send the bill back to the president.
But then we don't have any legislation, and we don't have any funding because the bill was vetoed. And then there's a new bill introduced, and this goes back to the Pelosi example that I gave earlier, a new bill that's introduced or not introduced that would say, we will do nothing. In
well,
other
that,
words, it, take it, the two
Harry,
extremes.
That's not practical. Doing nothing not only doesn't work in the House or the Senate, it doesn't work in America.
Because of the people who are there.
You've got U.S. troops on the ground, you know,
who
and
need
U.S.
to come
civilians
home.
On the ground, who you can't just stop funding them. They wouldn't, they would be put in a very, very danger, even greater danger than they are now.
Understandably. So instead, the president asks for $200 billion more dollars to be funded that will be borrowed from somewhere else.
Correct.
To whatever extent, increase the $9 trillion deficit. Where is the middle ground?
Well, I don't know that there's middle ground yet. I think we were closer to middle ground prior to the General Petraeus appearance on Capitol Hill. I think that Republicans were starting to join with Democrats and were willing to say that we needed to redeploy our troops. I think what happened was Petraeus made an argument that was convincing enough to the American people that a lot of the Republicans who were on the fence felt that they had somebody they could stand with, whereas before they knew they couldn't stand with President Bush, and they were starting to come over to our side. Now, it's not that's not the case in every district. Right after Petraeus's appearance on the Hill, Republican from upstate New York, Jim Walsh, a moderate Republican, he came out and said it's time to leave Iraq. Ron Paul, the more libertarian than Republican presidential candidate, has been making a lot of headway in his presidential efforts in opposing the war in Iraq. So Petraeus didn't stop the bleeding, but I think he stopped temporarily the hemorrhaging, and it's a matter of time before, we get the votes to demand that there's redeployment.
Time in terms of the next election?
Well, I'm hopeful that it's before the next election. I think that there's a lot of members of Congress who are now standing with the president and with General Petraeus on this issue, that as it comes closer to election time, they're going to start hearing from their constituents. And I think there are more of those constituents who understand that this is a real problem, and that this is we shouldn't have our troops in the middle of a civil war.
How about instituting a draft? What is your feeling on that?
Well, I think if we had a draft, I don't think we'd be in Iraq today.
Would you support a draft?
I'm not certain that I would support it, but I think it's something that should certainly be debated.
Men and women?
Well, if you're going to have men and women in the service, it would have to apply to men and women.
When you say you're not sure you would support it, what are your considerations?
Well, I would want to hear... I think we ought to go into the debate. I think we ought to have the debate. We ought to talk about troop levels. We ought to talk about retention. We ought to talk about recruitment. We ought to find out where we are on our needs and where we are in regard to meeting those needs. But from a philosophical perspective, I think that if everybody was in the same pot, and subject to being called to the draft, you'd have a lot more public scrutiny of what Congress does. I talked to somebody yesterday who said they weren't involved in politics until the Cuban Missile Crisis, and they thought, boy, I might get drafted, and they became very, very involved in this. So I think it took most Americans out of the debate with this modern volunteer army. And now you add to it, and the other issue that I think factors into this now is the reliance on civilian contractors and the mess that that's created and the money that has been wasted in regard to this.
Part of the $9 trillion.
Oh yeah, not only part of the $9 trillion, but it's The contractor money. I don't know what the breakdown is, what's been borrowed and what's just been budgeted, but it's not all supplemental for them. There's been other money spent that fall within the budget framework. So that means every dollar that went through the budget process that's being spent on Blackwater is money that can't be spent on children's health, on poverty programs, on health care programs, on building roads and doing the work that we need to do right here at home.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Congressman Mike Thompson at his office on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. about issues of the nation that are facing us when this program was recorded on Thursday, October 11th, 2007. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Mike, the issue of the war is supported by what the president says we must do to protect our nation from terrorism. What validity do you see in those statements, if any?
Well, we need to protect our nation from terrorism, but I don't think this war has anything to do with that. The fact of the matter is we should be spending our money to do the national security work that needs to be done here at home. I think our involvement in the Iraq civil war exacerbates our problems. We're making enemies over there every day. We're not winning hearts and minds. We're making enemies. Every time, you know, yesterday the story on the news, the Blackwater people shooting up a car with two women in it, killing both of the women. Every time some tragedy like that happens, you know, that each one of those women have left family members behind who I would venture to say aren't particularly thrilled with our U.S. foreign policy.
You mentioned the national security here at home. What needs to be changed, if anything, from your perspective, in terms of national security? Airport lines, the airport security check we have coming into this office building, into the Capitol?
Yeah, I think we have a lot of work to do at home, especially in the area of intelligence gathering. We need to be able to do a much better job at that, both here at home and in the countries in which we operate.
Well, you're on the Intelligence Committee.
I am.
I'm not sure how much of what you hear you would choose to reveal. Where are those lines as to what you know that?
Well, I chair the intelligence subcommittee on terrorism and intelligence, and there's a lot of work that we need to do.
In what areas?
In regard to recruiting folks for the intelligence community in our deployment and being better equipped to gather intelligence both overseas and here.
Well, in doing that, how far into the personal lives of the average American citizen do you think is necessary to go to protect the safety?
Well, I think you're blurring the line. What I'm talking about is not in the procedures that we use, but in regard to the procedures we use, I think that our Fourth Amendment rights have to be first and foremost. And I think
the protection against unreasonable search and
seizure. Absolutely. I think that you can. I think we can provide the national security and the intelligence for doing that, and at the same time protect our constitutional rights. That's been an issue here, and It was a big issue yesterday in the House because we passed out of both the Intelligence Committee and the Judiciary Committee the House Democrats' version of what the FISA law should look like.
FISA means?
The Foreign Intelligence Security Act. That's been the big debate of late. As you remember, in early August or right before the August recess, those laws were extended, and I think they were extended in a way that was far too overreaching. And this bill that we passed yesterday is the bill that will bring the constitutional protections back in line.
Let's talk about Social Security, and specifically Medicare. Recently, I had the opportunity to look at some material in the Ukiah Social Security office that talked about identity theft. And then I learned that when a person, the material related to identity theft said, protect your Social Security number specifically. And then I learned that when a person gets a Medicare card, their Social Security number is right on the face of the card, and it says, carry this card with you. It seems like there's a direct contradiction.
You had mentioned that to me when I saw you at home, and I have my staff looking into that. I think it's a problem. I think that the Social Security number has become far too common of an identifier, not just in Medicare, but just about any place you go, they want you to give them your Social Security number. And that's been something that's been creeping up on us for a long time. I'm old enough to have a Social Security card that states on the bottom, not for identification purposes. And I've been told all my life that that's one thing you don't want to give up. You don't want to share that number with anybody. And because it is a primary way by which people steal your identity.
Yet the Medicare card has the number on it, vaguely disguised with a letter afterwards, mm-hmm. With
just
a note that
could
says...
could probably fool anybody, huh?
Yeah, carry this with you at all times.
I think your military also does the same thing. Used to have your number, your military service number. Now it's merely your Social Security number. So I think there are a lot of areas where that's a real problem.
Is that something you can change?
Well, I don't know. I just started looking into it when you had mentioned it to me up in Hopland.
Marijuana is a big moneymaker in the 1st Congressional District, specifically in Mendocino and Humboldt County. And I understand that for the past many years, there has been legislation in Congress that would say, let the states decide. And if there is a federal arrest, the jury would be instructed as to the state law. Are you a supporter of that legislation?
I'm a co-author of that legislation and have been for a number of years.
Do you see any success on that?
I don't know. It's not had the support to pass. And I don't know what the status of it is now. The fact of the matter is that California voters passed an initiative that put in place certain laws pertaining to marijuana, and it seems to me that that's the law that we ought to follow, and other states have done similar things.
Mendocino County, through the Board of Supervisors, the sheriff, and the district attorney, say that a person can grow up to 25 plants and possess up to 2 pounds of processed marijuana. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I can tell you that it's causing some concern. I've been contacted by a lot of people in Mendocino County who have concerns with that and believe that their neighborhoods are adversely impacted by that ruling. Again, it's something that it should be. There should be more clarity in the state and federal law, and I think a lot of these issues that come about because of local ordinances or county ordinances would change.
In your experience being a member of the California legislature and a member of Congress, you've seen political machinations come and go and move or shift the paradigm. What's your take on this movement of the paradigm? Here we have a one of 58 counties in California, being very clear in what they're doing and choosing not to do. And it's contrary to what the federal government says. Do you think that's a safe thing or a wise thing for the county to do?
I think the other thing that you didn't mention was that Mendocino County, along with Humboldt County, each passed resolutions asking that marijuana be legalized. And I think it's high time to have that debate for a couple of reasons.
There are Congress?
In general.
Okay.
And there are a lot of folks who believe, and I think both of those resolutions alluded to this, that if it were in fact legalized, that would be an economic boom for those two counties. I'm not sure that that's true. I think if it were legalized, I don't think people would grow it, you know, back in the furthest, deepest, steepest canyon. I think it would probably be grown in Kansas and Iowa and, you know, other places where it could be easily grown and shipped to wherever it's going to be shipped. So I think this is one of the deals where all the facts need to be laid on the table. And the costs that the counties are experiencing, the environmental degradation because of growing marijuana, the wildlife degradation because of growing marijuana, the foreign cartel involvement in growing marijuana, and all of the externalities that introduces to the community. All those things need to be looked at. We need to figure out how to craft laws that work across all jurisdictions and do away with these ill effects.
And pending that determination, while these are waiting to be figured out, do you see any change, or would you recommend any change?
See any change coming. As I said, that the Mendocino County has decided to handle it one way,
and Orange County another way.
Another way.
And
yeah.
San Diego County is seeking to sue the state, challenging Proposition 215 that allows for medical marijuana.
Right. So I don't think it's something that's going to be solved in Congress during this session or the next, and probably not the next. And I think the first step is probably the state, with the understanding or with the caveat that the federal government should recognize what the states do.
Well, Mike Thompson, what is your personal experience with the growing or use of marijuana?
I've never grown marijuana.
And the next? Have you used it?
Well, of course I have. I grew up in the 60s and was in Vietnam, and don't now, and haven't for a long time. But
Mike Thompson, state children's health insurance program was passed by the House and by the Senate and vetoed by the President. What does this mean?
Right, it was reauthorized by the House, and it was improved. The existing program covers about 6 million kids, and the House and Senate bill expanded that. There were about 4.5 million additional kids who qualified, but there wasn't enough money in the program to include them. So it was expanded to include them, and it was fully paid for, 100% paid for. It was paid for by an increase in the per pack cigarette tax. And the President vetoed it, said that it was a slippery slope into socialized medicine or something, and which was curious because he says that he supports the program at a lower level. So it seems to me if at the higher level it's a slippery slope to socialized medicine, at the lower level it's the same slippery slope.
Same slope.
Maybe not as steep, maybe not as slippery, but still a slippery slope. So his arguments are a bit incongruent with reality.
But there's not enough votes to override the veto.
I don't know. I think there's enough votes in the Senate to override it. And there was a report today in one of the local papers about some Republicans who came out and said he was going to change his vote and vote to override. So it's going to be a battle.
And that's two-thirds in each House.
Correct.
To override.
And they're doing a pretty intense media program to bring to the attention of voters in these swing areas how important this program is. It's important for kids' health. It saves money because if you can catch a problem early on with a kid, it's a lot less expensive than if you have to treat a problem that becomes acute. And in addition to that, we started out this interview talking about Medicare, and healthy kids today translates into a healthy Medicare population in the out years. So this is a good program that needs to be funded, needs to be done at this level. And for the president to veto this bill, it was just a foolish, shameless veto.
So if we have healthy Medicare, that would require more Social Security being spent. Will there be Social Security money for the baby boomers?
Of course.
That's not going to be, that tap won't be turned off.
No. There needs to be adjustments as you.
But adjustments means
know.
Less money.
Pardon me?
Doesn't adjustment mean
could
less
be,
money?
Could be a higher age. Could be less money. I think everything has to be on the table. We haven't been willing to do that because this president and the previous majority wanted to do away with Social Security, wanted to privatize it, and I don't think you negotiate with folks who want to blow up the most successful government program in the history of this country.
Recently, you were able to get a rider onto a bill that would preclude offshore oil drilling along the Mendocino coast.
No, I did a bill. It's a regular bill that I've introduced. It's in the Resources Committee that would prohibit offshore drilling in Mendocino, Humboldt, and Delmarva.
So it's yet to be passed?
Yes.
Wasn't there an effort that was announced in the spring for which you claim credit to be able to stop offshore oil drilling for a period of time?
Well, there was an effort to repeal the prohibition, and we were able to defeat that.
So at this point,
there's no moratorium on in place.
The moratorium continues.
Correct.
Well, Mike Thompson, I want to thank you for giving us some time on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
I've just read a couple. I just read in the last, the last few airplane rides back and forth, the Blackwater book, which is, as a matter of fact, I just finished that last night. And before that, a novel that Senator Orrin Hatch sent to me. He has a friend who writes these real thriller type novels, and he sends them probably one or two a year, and I just finished that, and I just finished A Thousand Splendid Suns.
Well, Mike Thompson, thanks for being with us on Radio Curious.
My pleasure. Good to see you.
Congressman Mike Thompson represents the North Coast of California, including Mendocino County, the home of Radio Curious, in the United States House of Representatives. The books that he recommends are Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army by Jeremy Scahill, and 1,000 Splendid Sons by Khalid Hussein. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. At Radio Curious, we appreciate hearing from you. Our email is curious@radiocurious.org. The snail mail is 700 West Smith Street in Ukiah, UKIAH, California, 95482. The phone is 707-621-5075. Ignacio Ayala is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.